It's time for tech on the show today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along with us. We're talking about keeping your personal data safe on those high-tech devices that you have in your home and maybe in your pants pocket. Jesse LeGru back with us. He is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, also a volunteer handler for SANS Internet Storm Center. And as always, he'll talk about lots of things and answer your general tech questions, but we're going to zero in to begin on smartphone security, whether you can trust what AI tells you. We'll talk about the spread of AI to Google and Facebook, how to use it, and whether you can disable it. So lots going on today, and I hope you'll join in with your tech questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jesse LeGru, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's talk device security here a little bit. I'll be taking a few days of summer vacation. You may be as well. And how vulnerable is our personal data, when you're kind of away from the office and home?
Yeah, and it definitely depends on probably a couple factors. One, a lot of people take, let's say, pictures, for example, on vacations. Is it only stored on your phone? So if your phone has some kind of damage or, it has an accident, how do you get that information? So is it backed up anywhere? I think that's one of the items to think about. But if you lose your phone and somebody picks it up, what could they have access to? And usually those are the two things I really think about. Am I going to lose some of my data if I lose my phone? But is somebody going to be able to get some of that information if they pick it up, if it's sitting on a sidewalk or, somewhere else? So a lot of the items I usually think about to protect the information so no one can get to it is to, first have some kind of code or some way to unlock the device. So not having any kind of lock for a device can just make sure anyone who picks it up can easily get into the information. Another option, which tends to come standard for most phones today, but it's encryption. So if somebody can easily take the phone and plug it into another device, are they able to read data off the phone or find a way to take either the storage media, which could be like a little card, a micro SD card or an SD card, can they take that out and put it into another device to read it? Encryption is a big assistance for that to make sure no one can get that information. Later versions of Android OS and iOS for iPhones have those features turned on, so it should lessen the risk. But it's definitely something I think about. The more data you have on that device, the more risky it could be if somebody gets a hold of it.
Yeah. What about the, say you're in a cafe somewhere and you want to take a look at your bank account or your just use your computer in those kinds of situations?
Yeah, if using Wi-Fi or wireless from any one of those locations, an item I'd usually recommend for most, if you're on a network that you don't trust, if you're not sure who else is on that network, I always recommend using a VPN or a virtual private network. There are a lot of free options that are out there. You can get some paid plans, which offer some additional protection. But it helps to limit who can see inside of what this little virtual private network, what they call a tunnel. So basically, you're kind of in this protected area where no one can see the information you're submitting, which gives you a little bit of extra protection, not only from potentially people trying to attack your device on that wireless network, but from them being able to see the information that you're sending to your bank or to another location. So VPNs can be extremely helpful to make sure your information is protected when remote or even at home.
How difficult is it to set one of those up?
Most of the time, they're relatively easy to set up. Actually, a lot of iOS devices right now actually do have some VPN capabilities built in to help limit the information that can be shared or can be gathered. That can cause other issues, especially if you're accessing corporate resources, because it does show up in interesting ways on the other end. We're like, is this person traveling? And it turns out, no, they're not. That's just the new privacy features of iOS. So sometimes it can be transparent. You don't even think about it. And in other cases, you might have to install an app, turn it on when you want to use it, and go ahead and use it. Usually it's pretty straightforward. In many cases, you'll likely need to create an account with whatever VPN provider you'd like to use. ExpressVPN is one that's generally free. A lot of them have paid plans as well. You know, the biggest item is it supported on your device, whether it's an iOS device, it's an Android device, or something else? Most times they're supported on a variety of providers. So I haven't seen that be a challenge with popular service providers out there.
Eugene and Viola has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I keep getting telephone calls, and it comes up as an unknown number. And if I pick up this receiver, there's nothing there. I hit star 57. I've hit star 57 a few times, but is there any way to trace those back and find out who's doing it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's I think even escalated to getting those kind of spam phone calls recently. There's not a great way for any individual to trace those phone calls, and unfortunately, our current phone system makes it really challenging to trace a variety of those phone calls. Phone numbers can easily be what they call spoofed or faked. To make it look like it's coming from another phone number. As an example, I can actually load up an application on my phone. I can get it from the Google Play Store, download and install it within a minute or two, and actually start making phone calls to the fake phone number. And it's really, really easy. It's really accessible. Unfortunately, on the other end, to create those phone calls. And even if you do make a block for a specific phone number, since those phone numbers are easy to falsify, it's likely they'll pick another number. So there's not a great way to trace it. If there's any recommendation I would have to try, it would be to contact your phone provider. But I think in most cases, there's little they're going to be able to do just due to the volume of phone calls that are happening for anyone at any one time. It's going to be a challenging item to address. The only long-term way is really kind of rethinking how our phone system works to actually make that even more possible where phone numbers can't be falsified. But unfortunately, it's just really, really easy today.
Yeah. You wonder how many if anybody has done an estimate of the number, tens of thousands of those kinds of phone calls that occur every day in the United States. It's got to be millions.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about, you know, how many people that are around the country or around the world, we have a lot of phone numbers. I actually have multiple phone numbers. So even thinking about how many phone calls I get in a week, it's quite a bit. And most of the time, they're not from people I know. I'm getting phone calls from spammers or just general scams, and it's quite a large volume.
Yeah. Eugene, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Let's talk about updates for just a minute. I think most of my updates are just automatically done, but it's important to keep those up to date. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, and that's another thing I kind of recommend when traveling too is, you know, you want to lock your devices, but keep them updated to make sure security updates or functional updates are applied. Most devices will turn those updates on automatically. In some cases, that means the updates happen every day. In some cases, it might mean they happen every week. One of the ways, sometimes those are also customizable, sometimes they're not. It really does depend on the device. If I do want to make sure I have the latest updates, for example, on an Android, I might actually go directly to the Google Play Store, and it might show me I have pending updates. Usually at a certain time, it will automatically apply those. Unfortunately, those updates can also be turned off. And that might happen for a variety of reasons. Every now and again, you have an application that works, and if it doesn't work, it can be a significant challenge. So having an update break a program can actually be kind of challenging. So each person, each organization might choose to do that a little bit differently. That being said, I always recommend trying to keep your device as updated as possible. If there are those specialty applications that if it really doesn't work, and there is no workaround outside of that one application, test accordingly. But I'd probably also ask, if you don't have a backup plan when it breaks, create a backup plan. Because at some point, it's probably going to break. And it's good to know what to do if that happens. So always have that contingency plan and try to enable automatic updates as needed. But some testing might be necessary for my day-to-day use. I'm not concerned with applying updates automatically if something breaks. I either might be able to uninstall it or I might have another way to do the same thing. So for my standard personal use, automatic updates works great.
John wants to know about password. What's the best way to pick a secure password?
The best feature of a password to make it harder to break into is generally the length. One of the items that has really come over the last decade or two is what you need is a password with a lot of special characters, a lot of variety. So instead of just saying having a password, you want to have special characters, numbers, and letters. That's true, but it's actually more important to really have a longer password than it is to have a shorter password with very complex changes in that password. Because the complexity to try to break into a password as it's longer is far greater than it for a shorter password. So my recommendation, create longer passwords. And usually the recommendation is to use a passphrase. So that could be a sentence with hyphens or a variety of words. It could have changes in case in terms of uppercase, lowercase. You can always add numbers and letters, but really making that password as long as possible is going to be giving you a better benefit. In addition, being able to remember it is really important. So if you do use passphrases, if you use even sentences, it can be really helpful. But using biometrics can also be helpful. So that could be using a fingerprint. It could be using facial recognition. It could be using eye scanning. So those can also help to protect access to devices or to services without necessarily needing that strong password. So I'd also recommend looking at those other options because maybe a password, and I think things are going to kind of go in that direction of what they call passwordless. So not having to remember that password, but being able to identify that you're you in a way that's easy and lessens the likelihood somebody can falsify it.
Michelle in Shorewood has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've never called a radio before, so I hope I can get this out right. We're having trouble with the television turning on by itself at night, and it sounds like people are in the living room scaring me to death. Or the other thing, it will cut into, I'll be watching television. This is usually happens around 11:30 at night, and I'll have the TV on while I, get ready for bed. And this program thing will cut into a program, a show that I'm watching, and it has this weird kaleidoscope-looking picture, and it says, connect now to your mobile device to listen to music or something of that nature. And this is driving me crazy.
Well, it would bother me too if I'm sleeping and I suddenly hear a conversation going on down in the in the living room, or I'm getting some weird directions on what to do on my mobile device.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I think about when electronics abnormally turn on or turn off. So there are a few things I probably take a look at. One, it sounds like maybe you probably have a smartphone, and that a lot of the smartphones that we have today have the capability to stream to TVs, and they tend to do it. They automatically discover these devices. If you actually look at any home network, if you have a device with these scanning or with these broadcasting capabilities, they're scanning the network all the time, looking for a device that it can stream to. What I'd probably look at for the TV, if it does have any broadcasting features or smartphone features, I'd actually recommend turning them off, because it could be your mobile device or something else that's trying to connect to it and trying to turn it on, and also trying to broadcast. And when you noted the message about it sounded like it was waiting for input maybe from your phone. And it could be one of those features that are easily, you can accidentally hit a button on a phone. It could be in your pocket, your hands in your pocket, and it tries to broadcast something. So I try to turn those features off actually on your TV. If you don't use them, it's one less thing somebody else can attach. So for example, something that could happen with those features turned on, and if there's not a lot of security items enabled, someone close enough to your TV could actually be outside of your house and could actually broadcast to your TV, which is a whole other issue you can run into. But if you have those features turned off for your TV, then you hopefully shouldn't have it turning on, but it's going to lower the chance somebody else might be able to connect to it. Another thing I was thinking of, because we've actually seen this every now and again, if you have any devices that have remotes, sometimes the frequencies for remotes can have an overlap. And so I've actually seen trying to turn on a wireless fan ends up turning on it or turning off a different device. And just because it happens to actually have the same frequency, where that can occur. A garage door opener turns on a light in a different area because somehow it's able to make that pairing. So I'd keep an eye if you do have any other devices. If you hit a remote from some area, does it turn on something else? But I'd probably look in the TV. I disable any of those kind of broadcasting smart TV features, which I think will help, because it does sound like a device might be trying to connect to it and actually broadcast. And if you do that from a device, it's actually a really nice feature. Those streaming features will automatically turn on the TV. So you don't have to hit the power and then stream from a device. It will automatically turn on your TV and have it ready for the stream to start occurring. So it's possible that the smartphone's actually turning the TV on. Maybe it's streaming from your device, but it might just be turning it on enough so whatever you were watching at the time continues.
So, and is it difficult? It's been not too difficult to turn that device off for Michelle, would it be, if she's got a smart TV?
Yeah, and it depends on the TV. But usually you can go to the settings and they will have options for broadcast streaming from devices. A lot of times they might have it for like Apple specific streaming. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you look for AirPlay, usually you'll see something regarding AirPlay or other types of streaming, and you can turn those features off. The title might be different for each TV, but if you see AirPlay anywhere in there, that's a good indicator that it's receiving some kind of stream from a mobile device.
Michelle, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, our guest today. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your computer and your phone today with Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Zeroing in a little on security today, but we're taking other questions as well. And the number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. If you get improved security for your device, will it have an added benefit of improving the performance of that device?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's probably actually one of the items most people are concerned about is if you do have security updates or enable security features, it might slow down a device. A lot of times, sometimes the security updates will also improve the performance. Security is more than just, you know, making sure somebody can break into it. It tends to be also concerns with, you know, making sure the device is functioning properly and making sure that the data on that device remains valid or unchanged so somebody can't change it. So I would say yes. Can it slow things down when things aren't done properly? Yes, that can happen. Generally, you know, any update, whether it's security or feature related, should hopefully improve the function of the device. Feature updates, I would say, are probably more likely to slow things down. When we look at, you know, we're probably going to talk about it a lot more, but artificial intelligence, if there are other processes running in the background of your computer that weren't running there before, it could have the impact of slowing a system down. So with new AI features, if it is using local computing resources, there could be changes in performance. But generally, you know, the hope is it should work better, even if it's not working faster.
You mentioned artificial intelligence. We should talk about it. It's now showing up as a feature on Facebook and at the top of the Google searches as well. How can AI enhance the use of these online services?
Yeah, I think so artificial intelligence has the potential benefit of giving us hopefully more accurate information in a shorter time gap or a shorter amount of work. So whether we're talking about large language models or LLMs, which is really what we're seeing from a variety of features, including Meta AI or from Google Search, those should hopefully be able to interpret what we're actually asking for in a way that we're actually going to get better search results. At least that's the goal. In some cases, we actually might get less accurate information when we talk about hallucinations. if there's not a lot of information for that program in the back end to make a decision, it might start making stuff up. And so that can create a problem when we're trying to get information. And so there's kind of the balance between, you know, how much we can trust the data we're getting back based upon the data that was used to program it. So it's always, you know, I wouldn't even say trust, but verify. I would just say verify because you just never know how accurate that information is without having a background or being a subject matter expert in what you're researching or looking up.
I know Google had to scale back their AI-generated search results for that reason, getting inaccurate results. People were being told to eat rocks or put glue on their pizza.
Yep. And, you know, a lot of it's based upon either the information we're using to train these artificial intelligence applications. So either we might have information that's inaccurate, or we might have information that just isn't there. So there's no body of knowledge for the program to state, oh, this is, you know, how I would answer this question. So it might make something up. And so we have a variety. You can look on the internet and try to find out whether one thing is a fact, and you can find websites that will basically give you pretty much all of the options, even though if there is a fact, there's probably only one that can be true. But since all of the data is out there, it really requires effort to filter out some of that information or find a way to sanitize the data when training those programs. And that's a challenge when you want to just train something on the internet.
Yeah. Cheryl in Berlin, we'll go to you. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question for you. I listen to Alexa a lot, and every night about 7 o'clock, I go in my bedroom and I read or listen to music. And right at 7 o'clock, I heard Alexa in the kitchen, "Cheryl, pull down your shade." Is that kind of creepy?
That does sound a little creepy. And it's every night at 7 p.m.
Yeah, this happened a couple of times.
Well, I get something every night that says, at 9 o'clock, that says, "Larry, practice mindfulness." And so forth and so, you know, just giving me, you know, as you retire for the evening or whatever. So I get something kind of like that.
Yeah, and there are reminders you can set up with Alexa and a lot of the tools to automatically remind you at certain times. Part of me is actually curious whether somebody added a reminder for you, but you didn't get notified until Alexa actually reminded you, which feels a little bit more like a prank than anything else. That's the first thing that kind of comes to mind. Outside of that, I'm not sure what would cause the Alexa to really give you that reminder, unless it was somebody that pre-programmed it.
Yeah, it may have been pre-programmed on mine. I don't know. I certainly didn't put it in myself. I don't mind the reminder in that case. You know, it's comes up at a time when it's probably an appropriate time for me. But I never stopped to think about how it got there. But it was probably pre-programmed. Cheryl, that's what we got for you. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. On Saturday, I was using my Android phone, and then a flash sale popped up for the Duluth Trading Company, and they had quality items at a good deal, and you had 20 minutes to make your selections and your purchase. And so initially, I did enter my email, but I didn't set up a full account with a password. And I started noticing that there were unbelievable deals, such as a $400 quality leather duffel bag for $19. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm wondering, is there something going on with this? And so as I was going through all of this, it kept counting down. You have X amount of time, and all of a sudden, it disappeared. So I checked my history to see if I could find out where did this come from, but nothing displayed. And I'm wondering, how can I check whether something got attached to my phone through this situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So depending on... So one of the risks could be, you know, if you clicked on something either on a website or something else, could some kind of malicious program, something else be on your device? What I'd probably look at first would be any applications you have listed. If it's iOS, it's going to be in the App Store. If it's Android, it's going to be in the Google Play Store. You know, look for anything that's unusual or that you don't need. Disable or uninstall anything that looks unusual. One of the items I'd probably recommend, if there is really a concern where something else might be on your device, there's a variety of malware that's been reported out there over the last several years that doesn't require you to install anything. It doesn't actually require you to do anything potentially. Granted, these are very well-developed like nation state level applications, but they take advantage of a lot of vulnerabilities that exist in devices and ones that aren't disclosed. It's doubtful that's the level of risk you probably have for your device, but one of the best ways to help address it is restore your device. So reset it, restore the data that you might need from it if you're really concerned. One item that it has been pretty common on either Google search results, could be anything that's ad driven, is malicious ads. And so this has even been seen when looking at Google results. You might see certain sponsored ads or items that, you know, are at the top of the shopping list or something else. If those are dangerous in some way because somebody paid for them to get up there, it is possible to be redirected to a site that's dangerous. Usually, if that's the case, so if you did put your email address into this website, for example, I'd probably recommend, if you don't think it's legitimate, it sounds like it might be a little suspicious based upon, I guess, the discounts that maybe are far too steep than what they should be. I might consider just blocking that content or even reporting it if you're receiving it in your email. One item that you can do with Google is you can report if you do see suspicious ads, depending on the different products or different applications you're running on your phone, you might be able to do the same thing. But anytime when I see a notification that is trying to give you a timer, which means it's trying to not make you want to panic, but make you want to act quickly, right? Because you're going to get a deal within 20 minutes. Anytime where there's some urgency to take some kind of action is usually an indicator for me. This may be dangerous. Somebody might be trying to social engineer me. They're trying to trick me into clicking on something. And so that's something I just keep an eye out for in general. Sometimes those might actually be legitimate, but a lot of times they try to take advantage of kind of our own anxiety to take action or to miss out on something. But you know, if you are concerned with something on your device, I'd recommend a backup and restore your information, including any applications you need. But you can also just look at any applications that might be installed in your device using Google Play or the App Store. And then just keep an eye. If you do see an ad and it is a great deal and it's sponsored, sometimes those sponsored ads have been problematic and have basically been paid for by scammers to try to get more people to click on it.
Yeah. Christina, thank you for calling. Along that same line, Ken had emailed to say they're having trouble. They keep getting fraud alerts, letting them know they need to get a new credit card. And that, I would call the credit card company on that.
Yep.
Right on the back of your card is the number.
Yeah, and that's what I'd recommend doing as well. And sometimes, and a lot of the fraud prevention services, they change over time, but a lot of them are a little bit more automated. So you're going to get a phone call, you're going to get a text message to validate charges. But those same kinds of automated notifications can also be falsified. So someone might try to state they're the bank and try to get you to enter information that you don't want to. Looking at the back of your card, calling that phone number, since you know it's should be the legitimate phone number, is a good idea. Or even physically going to your bank and sitting down with the person can also assist. So anytime I'm contacted from a different source, if I'm not quite sure about who that is, I'll go to the original source where I know physically they're located here. I know that their phone number is this. I'm going to ignore what I received and try to contact from a trusted method that is publicly posted and I know it's legitimate.
Credit card companies, this just happened to me yesterday. I got a notice from my credit card company about a tip that I had given that was out of line with a normal tip. And it was too much, or it was higher than normal. And wondering if this is correct. They weren't asking, you know, if it's correct, fine. And the only reason that it happened was I paid partly cash for something, and then I put the rest on my credit card for that meal. So I put the tip in based on the total price. And my credit card company was right there. I was pleased to see that, to say, did you really tip this much?
Yep. And I think that's one of the benefits of having machine learning or artificial intelligence, AI, to keep an eye on certain items. This looks a little bit unusual based upon what you've done in the past. This percentage of tip, for example, looks odd based upon your previous activity. And so getting those indicators is really, really helpful. And, you know, I think we've been seeing it much more often in the last few years. But as we see a lot of other services adding other artificial intelligence features, Alexa even being one of those, if Alexa can better interpret what we're saying to actually get a better result, I think we're going to see dramatic changes, both in how those devices function, but in the suggestions we'll get, because they're going to get to understand, I guess, what our day-to-day normal looks like and tell us when there's deviations.
Well, in that case, I think the tip would have worked out to like 39% or something, as opposed to the, you know, the more normal 20% or so. Anyway, I thought, well, they're keeping track. That's all right with me. Peter and Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. Great program. See, I may have screwed up. I got Windows 11, and I didn't like the OneDrive, where it takes your information from your computer and stores it up in the cloud. So I turned that off, and then I made a new folder for my computer to drop everything into. But I think I might have screwed up someplace. I was trying to get into the app data folder today to find a lost document. And in the user file, there's no app data there anymore. Could I have set my main folder up improperly, Windows 11?
So that's a good question. So it's possible the folder is still there. So usually by default, it's hidden. One item, if for whatever reason I can't see a folder, but I believe it's there. So let's say it's C users, whatever your username is, and then app data. If you type that into the Explorer bar and hit enter, hopefully you're just going to see everything appear and you're actually going to see that content, because it could be hidden. If the app data folder itself was actually missing, it's possible Windows would crash, but I'm not sure. I haven't tried it. I wouldn't recommend it. usually app data is a hidden folder where a lot of your settings for your user account are stored. It's likely it would either get recreated the next time you log in, or Windows would be pretty upset. But I just try to type it in the Windows Explorer bar that you normally have at the top. Otherwise, if you go to the folder settings when you're in your user folder, you can toggle the option to show hidden folders and files. And that should hopefully show the listing where you're going to see the app data folder and a lot of other hidden folders. And so I would take a look there to look for it. Otherwise, you could also search to see if you can find the folder just on your device. It's possible it moved it into a different location that's hard to find. And so those would be my recommendations. Otherwise, I'd also just check the recycling bin. Maybe for some reason it accidentally got deleted. And usually it won't empty it unless you take some action or have it automatically set up to delete after a week. So hopefully you can find the information there. But if I feel the folder's there but I can't see it, usually typing it in to hit enter, even if it's a hidden folder, it should show up in Explorer and you should be able to look through any of the files and folders. I also will note I recently had to fix somebody's computer that had an issue. They were actually using the OneDrive feature, which was storing all of their documents and folders. So they, you know, their desktop folder was blank, their documents folder was blank, everything was in OneDrive. I was surprised at how easy restoring Windows was, where I could reset it to factory defaults. They logged in with their account. All of their files just magically appeared because OneDrive was able to synchronize it. And so while there's, you know, the potential risk because Microsoft now has those files, it can make the restoration process, if you ever have an issue, really, really easy. So just kind of a note, obviously, if you have sensitive files you don't want Microsoft to have, you know, keep them on your device and don't use that OneDrive feature. That OneDrive feature can also be really, really nice if you do need to recover from an accident, because you kind of, you have an automatic backup.
Peter, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your computers and your phones today with our guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Great to have him with us today. Questions or problems that you've had, or maybe just a general question about a computer or your phone, join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Jim and Kenosha, will give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Yes, going back to the smartphones, one of the things that really helps me is you got to make sure your Wi-Fi and Bluetooth are off when you're out doing something. Now, sometimes you might be hooked up to your stuff, but if you're not using it, shut it off, because other people, you can accidentally link on. And then the other thing is you're draining your battery, because when Bluetooth or Wi-Fi are on.
Yep. Yeah, I think we just lost them. Well, what do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea for a couple of reasons. I think the power item is a really good consideration. So if you don't have Wi-Fi you're connecting to or any Bluetooth devices you're using, it's good to turn it off. And that's the case with any feature you might have turned on for your iPhone, but it's also the same for applications you have installed or anything else. If you don't need it, remove it, disable it, because it's usually going to save storage, it's going to save battery life, and it's also going to help reduce ways that a device could be attacked, whether it's either through Bluetooth or wireless. It's always an example when people talk about going to like security conferences, DEF CON being a primary example. If you come in with your own device with a lot of things turned on, you might expect it to be compromised by the time you get home, because people will find ways to attack when you're connected either on Wi-Fi, or if they're close enough, they can use different kinds of attacks via Bluetooth as well. Sometimes even when a device is off, there might still be ways to interact. But having those items turned off when you don't need them is a good idea. And that's the case with a smartphone. That's the case also with a laptop. If you don't need them turned on, turn it off. It just simplifies a variety of things. When you have a lot of things turned on, it can actually make troubleshooting issues really, really difficult. So if you don't need it, turn it off.
Let's take another call. Peter in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I had a question about the dark web. My email provider, my internet provider has told me my information was leaked to the dark web. I wonder what to do next. But another question would be, if I ask an email broker to remove my name from their list, is this by law they must do this, or is just a request? And then a similar, if I ask an email sender to unsubscribe, is there any law they must unsubscribe?
That's a good question. So I'll probably caveat with, I'm not a lawyer, so I only know so much about what's out there in terms of the requirements for different organizations. One thing I will note is the US is very different from Europe. So having regulations like GDPR and data privacy is something that the United States is, we'll say, behind on. California is a little bit more up to date with regulations like CCPA for their own Privacy Act. So it may differ based upon where you're actually coming from, where you're physically located, and your residence. There's nothing that necessarily states somebody needs to remove your information. They might keep it. If it's on the dark web, or if it's even on the internet in general, you can request that information to be removed, but it can be challenging to actually get the data out there. If it is some hosted by an individual, it might be hard to also track that individual down. It may not be an organization, for example, it might be a person, and it can be really challenging to get it removed. There are a lot of third-party companies that actually offer services to try and redact or remove your information from the internet. Usually they require monthly subscriptions, maybe annual subscriptions, in which they will try to look for your information and remove it, and try to make those requests for you. But in terms of kind of the legal backing that enforces those removals is challenging. Just because every region, those regulations are different. And so it depends on where you're physically located, but potentially also where the infrastructure is physically located that's hosting your information. Both may be impacted for those requests. So usually if the information is out there on the internet somewhere, it's kind of out there, and there are methods that can be done to remove it. But there are also services out there that kind of scrape internet data, and so it's hard to truly remove that information if it's out there, because something else might be backing it up and storing it in a different way, or even posting it in a different way. I always say, you know, for a lot of those, you can make the request. I am a little bit more careful with unsubscribe buttons, because even those themselves, you're never quite sure what's on the other end. Is this a valid unsubscribe? Could I potentially be using this unsubscribe button, but actually getting subscribed for something else? Because the trustworthiness of that other side is hard to know. For the information, you know, that might have been, you know, out there on the dark web, I'd always be, you know, concerned with identity theft, or just making sure your private information is protected. If you think there might be any risk of fraud, you know, definitely reach out to your bank, the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, and a variety of other resources are out there to help with identity theft. I do recommend for people, you know, if you don't need to use your credit often, you can get a credit freeze, which allow basically make sure no one can take credit out in your name, and it's easy to unlock when you need it. So there are other protections you can at least put in place. So if people get certain information, it lessens the chance they can do something bad with it.
There you go. Thank you so much, Peter, for calling. Appreciate your call. Carl wonders in Platteville if you have a recommendation for which password creator organizer app you recommend.
I would recommend really what works for you is the biggest thing. So whatever is going to help you get the best password to keep track of it, and to use on a day-to-day basis is really what I'd recommend. You have a lot of options for passwords. It can be stored on your device, which means that if you are using a different device, you can't access those passwords. Maybe that's fine and that works for you. For me, I use a variety of devices, so I actually do use a cloud solution, so I can access the same passwords on my mobile device that I can on my desktop.
Makes good sense. All right, well, Jesse LeGrue is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and we will be back with Jesse. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time for our tech update, of course, with Jesse LeGru, Information Security Officer at Madison College. Questions about your own computer or your own phone? I hope you'll join in. Maybe it's a security question. Maybe it's just something that's not working right. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Julie in Manitowoc. Julie, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon. Well, I can't access an email account. When I try to access it, I use my fingerprint, usually, but it won't let me. And then I get a message saying no passkey available. I didn't put a passkey on the account. And then it says passkey not found. Try creating a new one. And it won't let me.
Yeah. What do you think, Jesse?
So it could be a couple items. Are you trying to use a web browser to access your email, like Firefox or Chrome?
No, I'm actually using the app.
Okay. What I'd probably try to do, just if you can, I probably would try using the web application just to see if you can get access in a different way. It's possible that you might either need to reset your account in order to get access through kind of the biometric, which it sounds like you're using a fingerprint. It could potentially be an issue with how the passkey or how the biometric is stored. But what I'd probably try to do is first try to access either using a different device from a web browser to see if you can access in that way, just to make sure you do have access to your account. Otherwise, you may need to change that biometric. Are you using an iOS device or an Android device?
Android.
Okay. And generally, I use, I have a biometric to unlock my device, but not my email. It's possible that the biometric on the device had some kind of issue, which you could probably reset. I'd start with accessing your email from a web browser on a different device. I just want to make sure you have access to email. Beyond that, you might have to see if you can find a way to reset the biometric for your device. Do you use your fingerprint to unlock your phone as well, or just to access email directly?
Yes, but I have a question. Use a browser. Can I use the browser on my phone, or does it have to be a different phone?
You could probably use it on your phone. If you do run into the same issue, I'd probably recommend trying a different phone. If there is something with your device itself that's having an issue, it's nice to have a separate device to test with, just to see if you do get different behavior. Try it on your device. If you run into the same issue, though, I'd probably still, try a different mobile device, or even try, a desktop or a laptop where you can just access the primary web page version. A lot of email systems, so if you try to, for example, go to gmail.com or even Outlook, even the browsers might redirect you to the application, which is what we're trying to work around. So it could be useful to actually use a different device, but it's worth giving a try. If you do have the same issue, I would try a different device.
Julie, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. John had called and couldn't stay with us, wondering where he can find a tutorial for operating a new cell phone. He said he hasn't found helpful YouTube videos.
Oh, that's a good question. So it probably will depend on the type of device you're using. If it's a smartphone, usually you can get pretty good information, whether it's going to be an Android-based device or an iOS-based device. If you actually have an iOS-based device, what I'd probably recommend, actually going to an Apple store, because you actually might get really good thoughts and feedback there. If you have an Android device, you actually might want to go to your cell phone provider, because they actually might have some information they can give you at the store or recommend other resources to go to. If you do have an Android device, you might be able to get some information on Google, but it may not really scratch the surface for a new smartphone user in terms of, you know, how to use it, what things to keep in mind. You tend to not get manuals with cell phones in terms of how to use it. So the only resources you're really going to have available are likely to be the ones you're going to find in cell phone providers, stores that sell those devices, or other online materials. The nice thing with a lot of stores is sometimes they'll have events for people on how to use certain devices, whether it's a Windows device, a macOS device, an Android device, and it's specifically geared towards new users. So there's likely something in your community or a close community that will have some kind of instructional area where you can learn a little bit more about your device. But first, if it's iOS, go to an Apple store. That's going to be the best place to go to start. If you do have an Android device, go to any store that actually sells them, because you might find out they actually have classes that are either free to get into, or they'll know of a resource to get to. So you can actually get more instruction actually from a person. That's probably going to be even easier, because they'll tell you, you know, how do you want to use the device? Let me show you how to do that. Because our smartphones can do a lot. You may not care about 90% of it. You only might want to know how to do two things, and actually going directly to one of those resources might help you out.
Good points. How can you tell, here's another question from a listener, how can you tell if an email attachment or website is maliciously trying to steal access to your device?
Yeah, it's a good question. Without diving into a lot of resources, it's hard to know, actually. In some cases, when looking at an email, it may be difficult to understand where is a link going to. Is that resource legitimate? Is it dangerous? One of the items people usually recommend, if you have a link, to know if it's safe or not, you can hover over it to understand, is the website going to a safe location? Does it look safe? Just because it looks safe, unfortunately, doesn't mean it is. And so I think that's the most challenging aspect of pretty much every email. You know, you're never quite sure if a link is going to be valid. In many cases, people will change characters, and it some character sets look very, very similar, but they're different.
Yeah.
So it may look like Google.com, but it might not actually be Google.com. So what I'd always recommend is assume it's dangerous, especially if you didn't anticipate the email. If you didn't anticipate the email, if you didn't anticipate the attachment, you have no idea what it's for. If they're talking about an invoice that you've never done business with a company, I'd probably recommend not opening it or even ignoring or reporting the email. Otherwise, if you do get an email that's asking you about something and trying to get you to go to a link, rather than clicking on the link, you can either type in the URL or go to that source on the internet and try to retrieve it manually from your account. So for example, if you get an email from your bank saying, hey, this looks unusual, please click on this link to open your invoice. Usually you can go directly to the portal for your bank, log in yourself, and you're going to have a different area within that portal to find the same invoice. So navigate to it manually rather than clicking on the link, because you just never know if that link is going to go to the right place, or if it's, you know, legitimate. So those be my recommendations for the attachments. A lot of email systems will try to filter out anything that's dangerous, but they're not 100%. They can still load a website that might be dangerous. And a lot of times you'll have, let's say, a PDF document that instead of having malware in that document, it has a link to a different place that is trying to collect information or that has malware. So the document itself looks safe, but the destination it's going to take you to is unsafe. And so whenever you see something where one thing is leading you to another thing that's leading you to another thing, that can also be an indication someone's trying to hide something. It shouldn't be this difficult to get what you're going to. So they might be trying to hide that dangerous nature by making you go through multiple steps.
Oh, man. Let's talk about AI a little bit more. Is the next generation of AI, is that's being trained by what we do on social media, or is it?
Yeah, well, and it depends on the AI or artificial intelligence we're talking about. So I would say generally, yes. So a lot of AI models are being trained on publicly available data sources. A lot of those might be social media. As an example, Facebook or Meta, a lot of information is likely being trained from interactions people have on Facebook or information they have publicly posted. With the privacy question that came up earlier in terms of, if I request this information to be removed, will it be removed? Well, it depends on where you're located. So I think one of the items that's a lot of people aren't comfortable with is Meta using information from Facebook to train AI models, whether it's public or non-public data. And because of the European Union requirements and their privacy laws, they have different notification requirements for certain changes to privacy than we do in the United States. And so that's highlighted some items where we don't think we're going to let you turn on those features. So a lot of Meta AI features to collect and train data are enabled for the US, but they're not enabled for the European Union simply due to their legislation. So that's some of the challenge behind, you know, where you're located matters in terms of what data is being used. But definitely, I'd say any source that people can try to find information and make these profiles, honestly, people are trying to make this better for the consumer. So if they can learn more about an individual's habits, it can generally train how to serve that individual a little bit better. And so that could be Facebook, that could be, you know, a different device for home automation that you have. Maybe if it knows you go to bed at 8:30 every night, it can automate certain tasks around your house or make it more comfortable for you when you're sleeping. So there's a lot of options for it. And I think people are going to use just about any data source they can get that's going to give them a better end result.
Karen in Westport, we'll go to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate
Thanks
the
for
call.
Taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a little info that we had sent a package by the United States Post Office, and I was tracking it. And this has happened about 2 weeks ago. And when I tracked it, you know, it just said didn't arrive yet. And about 10 minutes later, we received an email stating that your package is at the main hub because there's information missing. And please click the link, complete the information, and we will route the package. And that seemed really odd to me. So I called the post office, totally fraudulent. Even the wording, you know, like, we wishing you a very nice day is how they, you know, signed off. And I said, that doesn't sound like, you know, a normal email from the post office. So it was totally fraudulent. So
yeah, and there you were, and it's a sort of a case of bad timing. It would have been pretty easy just to go ahead and give that information. I actually had somebody, a friend who had been at the bank clearing up some things and got back, and then there was an email saying, we need some more information from you. And it was the same bank, and she had her identity stolen. It wasn't the bank. It was somebody else, and just by chance, the timing was perfect. And she didn't even think about it and just went ahead and did the information. And then it was a mess for a long time to clear that up.
Yeah, and there's definitely a lot of, and USPS or UPS even, I've seen both, having you know, please give me more information. I've gotten a lot of texts with that, also emails, and they're looking for, you know, they're looking for your information. Or in some cases, I know somebody who got a UPS one, and when looking at it, they did really well on the logos. It looked very, very accurate when thinking about, if I just clicked on it, am I going to think this is a legitimate website? It looked really, really good. Looking at the URL, it looked a little different. But you didn't really know it was a scam until you got to the end where it was asking for your credit card for a $2 charge so you could, you know, change your shipping. In the end, it didn't, you know, it didn't just want to click. It wasn't going to install malware. What it really wanted was your credit card information.
Yeah, yeah. Karen, thank you for calling. Matt in Fitchburg emailed to say they're longtime users of Windows Office, primarily Word, and every year about this time they encourage or attempt to shut down Matt's service and get Matt to repay about $100 to renew the service. There doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to it. Is this standard operating procedure for Microsoft subscriptions?
It depends on the subscriptions. Generally, I think right now, and this is very common with a lot of software today, it's becoming less of I buy it and own it than I subscribe to it. So Microsoft Office, for example, is one of those where you might be paying per month or annually to maintain using the software or to get software updates. It could be either one. But having a regular subscription fee is actually getting more and more common. Microsoft is one of them. Some organizations, you're able to get some benefits for Office for free. In other cases, you might have to purchase it. I do have one that I use for testing, and it is an annual subscription that I pay once a year to Microsoft to maintain my license. It doesn't mean the emails you're getting are legitimate. So whenever anything always asks for money, I always try to double check for Microsoft what I'd actually recommend doing. If you log into your Microsoft account directly rather than clicking on any links, there's usually going to be a billing section which will take you to any subscriptions you have. So you know you're going to go directly to the source to make sure the information's accurate.
Yeah, makes good sense. Frederica in Blue Mounds called to say they're getting about a dozen robocalls a day, some of which are political. Is there a way to stop them?
Not a great way. So there's some ways you can report to the FTC and to others in terms of spam phone calls. One of the recommendations I'd really have for anyone, keep your phone number as private as you can. So, and what some recommendations are, and you can get like a free Google Voice number or other like voice over IP services, but have a phone number you use for yourself and have a phone number you use for all the other things that you're never really going to monitor or actually don't care about. As soon as your phone number gets listed in any public area, it's likely going to be collected and reused for something which could be either legitimate, but more spammy, or they could be scammy where they're trying to take advantage of you and do social engineering. So the less you can have your information out there, the better. I would say report what you can in terms of this is a fraudulent call. Most cell phones do actually have a report feature, which will go back to your provider. They will take that and also hopefully feed that up higher so that it can be collected. The downside is with phone number spoofing, it can still make that a little bit more challenging. But reporting is the best thing you can do at the moment and try to get your information as hidden as possible. The less people that have your data, the less they can use it. But even then, people will just randomly guess phone numbers. And so that's the challenge with robocalls is they can try every phone number. They just have to keep going. And eventually they're going to hit your phone number.
Judy emailed to say they have an Apple MacBook Air laptop, repeated problems using a wireless printer. Judy has two different printers installed and they print a time or two, but then they quit working. Judy said an IT person said he could install a wireless printer for $75, but in a short time I would have to have it reinstalled.
What I'd probably look at is, so there's a couple different ways you can print to the printer. You could use kind of a standard network, which is usually you plug it in or it's wireless, or you can use Bluetooth. If you're using Bluetooth printing, you need to generally be a little bit closer. And so that could potentially be an issue when you're trying to print. If you are using Bluetooth, using a wired or wireless connection might be a little bit easier. You might actually find if you do have a home network, if you do have a wireless network connection, you might actually be able to plug in your printer into your home network, which most devices these days can just find. If you're on wireless and you're on that same local network, it can probably find it and print to it. That might overall help. One of the challenges with printers is the address might change. And so that could be creating issues when you're trying to print. Well, yesterday it had one address, tomorrow it has a different address. There are other things you can do to make sure that doesn't change. But a lot of times you may need to rescan your local network. So it's going to be different from device to device. One thing I'd recommend, if you have access to it, you can try to set an address that doesn't change. For any of those items, though, you might still need help. So if you don't know how to necessarily change those settings, it still might be a good idea to have somebody come and take a look at your home network and either plug it in or set it up wirelessly. You might be able to plug it in without any additional purchase. And then as long as you have it so the address doesn't change, hopefully it helps with that overall experience.
Yeah, I just plug mine directly directly in, and I never have any problems that way. For sure. I had problems, and then I just started doing it directly, and I eliminated all those problems. Well, Jesse, it's always a pleasure. Gosh, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and hopefully you'll be back with us again.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much. Jesse LeGrew is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he assists in implementing strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data. It's always great to have him with us, and he will be back in a month or two, and we'll do it all over again with him. Coming up, we're going to take a look at photography. How'd you like to take better photos? What about equipment? We can talk about all of those things next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Little Paul Simon to get us going here in our next segment of the program as we talk photography. You may not consider yourself a photographer or a great one, but here you are in your pocket. You probably have a camera built into your smartphone, and you may take pictures with it almost every day. Larry Mueller here will have a few tips for you about taking photos and better camera equipment. Your photos could better capture the important events and the people in your life. Here to tell us how, Jeff Dobbs, general manager of Mike Crivello's Camera and Imaging Center in Brookfield, Wisconsin. It's great to have Jeff with us. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Are you thinking about buying a digital or maybe a film camera? You want to take better photos with the equipment you have, maybe? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Jeff Dobbs, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, I think it's been since 1969, Mike Crivello's Camera Center has been in operation in the Milwaukee area. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you've been the general manager there, I believe, for a long time.
Well, I've been in the photo industry, I'm starting to tell people, 40 years now. And I've been at Mike Crivello's for 24, and either a manager or general manager for a good portion of that.
Oh, man. What's the biggest change in photography equipment you've seen over the past decades?
Well, certainly the digital revolution from the 1990s until the year 2000, when we were selling $30,000 cameras that today we could replace with easily a $400 or $500 camera. It's probably about 10 times better. But now we're going through another revolution in cameras that's very exciting, and it's a mirrorless camera replacing a mirrored camera called a digital SLR digital single lens reflex, basically standing for the fact that it has a mirror in it. But now they've hybrided the camera and the video together, and they have a tracking system in the new mirrorless cameras that'll identify a human face or an animal and track it wherever it may go. It's a huge advantage when it comes to keeping pictures in focus.
Oh, man, is it ever... and this whole business of smartphones, I think there were a lot of camera places that may have gone out of business when the smartphones came in.
Well, the smartphones and online dealers having an unfair tax advantage for many years put camera stores out of business. But we persevered, and now we're looking at a whole new world where the young people are coming in our store, and teenagers through early 20s, and they love film photography again. And so our lab has been very busy. We sell used film photography cameras, and it's a very exciting thing to see a lot of young people who lived in the age of the digital phone their whole lives, but they're more interested in an analog camera, and it's very fascinating.
What's the, and I remember my days with analog cameras, which the quality of the picture is different, isn't it?
Yeah, they seem to really like the look of the film camera. It's a look that some of the digital cameras have tried to digitally create, but there's certainly a look of the film camera that a lot of the young people like. And the interesting thing about it is that they all think it's a miracle if the picture turns out.
Megan Boysfield called to say that she has difficulty taking photos of food without getting a glare. And there's all kinds. What do you suggest in a situation like that?
Well, you have to put something that's white translucent between the light source, be it if it's an artificial light source, or the sun may be coming through a window that's going to make the light much less harsh and soften it, much like the clouds do when the sun is behind it. It becomes a very large, soft light source, and everything looks very good. Out in the middle of the day with the sun being very harsh, everything looks very harsh and contrasty. So you have to soften the light.
Yeah, it's like the old saw about taking photos at noon is not a good time. The middle of the day is not the best time to be taking photos.
Absolutely. In fact, the golden hour of photography, either in the morning or the evening, is still a rule that applied to film photography, black and white photography, and current digital photography of all types today, because the quality of light is more important than the medium that you're using to capture it.
So which hours in the morning and in the evening are best?
Well, usually a couple hours after sunrise and a couple hours before sunset is the best time to shoot most things. You have an angled light and much more complimentary. And then also the overcast. Many people overlook the fact that when you shoot pictures in the overcast, let's say, of flowers, that the colors will pop and the clarity will pop, and you'll probably like them a whole lot better than shooting in the hot, glary sun.
Yeah. Andy and Stevens Point have something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Good afternoon. I've got a question about selling some Hasselblad equipment. I'd like to move into digital, but in order to afford it, I've got to get rid of some other stuff before I do it. And I'm just wondering if there still is a market for medium format film cameras.
Well, the market's getting better on that every day. And you bought the Hasselblad cameras are about the finest that there are. And if they're mechanical ones that don't require batteries, they'd be very desired. The only problem with the Hasselblads are the ones that do require batteries that you can't get any longer. But then there's still the lenses that would certainly have some significant value. And we'd be happy to take a look at it for you.
Yeah, there you go, Andy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And speaking of that, Bob emailed to say, I've had this camera for many years and still mostly use the automatic setting. What are some good ways to go to get beyond autofocus and learn more about the camera and the various settings and options?
Well, one thing that we do here at the store is we have both classes for a number of people who maybe just bought a camera or people who want to learn more about the specifics of photography. And then we also have a guy here who will do one-on-one tutorials with people. But quite commonly what people do today is they go to, let's say, the Canon Camera Learning Center or the Nikon Camera Learning Center, and they go and watch tutorials on specific things that people are shooting pictures of. And a lot of times that will pertain to, you know, your interests as well.
What are the differences between the photos you can take with an iPhone versus a high-end digital or film camera?
Well, typically the biggest difference in image quality you're going to get from a phone to a camera is going to be due to the sensor size itself. A physically large sensor in a camera is a good thing for image quality. The phone will always be dictated by the size of the phone, even though that changes a little bit over time. They use a very small sensor in it, the size of maybe a pinky nail. And in a professional digital camera, we use a sensor the size that film was, 35 millimeter film typically, and it's 24 by 36 millimeters, and it's about 10 times the size of the sensor in the phone. And the bigger the sensor, you can either put more pixels into it or you can make them better in low light. The combination that people are buying today is a combination of a 24 megapixel digital camera in a full frame sensor size. And the quality of it is, it's better than it's ever been in the history of photography.
Yeah, interesting. Kathleen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello, Larry. I really enjoy this conversation today. So my dad was a photographer for the Los Angeles Times for 20 years. And I remember when I was just a little kid, he set up one of his cameras through one of our bedroom windows to catch a lightning storm over Ventura, California. Mm-hmm. And he just had it set to go off every 10 seconds or something like that. Ran through like three rolls just trying to get one shot, which is something that, you know, I'm sure we still have some things like that today, but, you know, you don't have to kind of sit there and hover like that.
but he wanted the perfect picture.
Yeah, he covered, you know, every wildfire season that there was in L.A. County for the longest time, and the 1989 earthquake and stuff. And so it was always, as a kid, for me, it was always about the story behind the camera as much as it was the story in the picture. So
Interesting. Kathleen, thanks for calling. Comment, Jeff?
Well, I think that today a lot of people are very snap happy with digital cameras and shoot thousands of pictures that really aren't fantastic, where the guys in the past who were shooting the film cameras and working for the news agencies were based on timing of things, but they certainly shot up a lot of film to make sure that they got something worthwhile for their assignments.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathleen, that's a great story. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can trade in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Talking with Jeff Dobbs, general manager of Mike Ravello's Camera and Imaging Center. Mike Ravello's Camera and Imaging Center in Brookfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Question about photography or cameras? You've come to the right place here. Jeff Dobbs is ready to answer your questions. Jeff, general manager of Mike Ravello's Camera and Imaging Center in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Mike in Rice Lake. Mike, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have a Canon digital camera, and I'm curious about the lifespan of the digital camera. I keep hearing it's good for so many shots, and then you can't do anything with it anymore. Is that true, or what is the expected lifespan of a digital camera like that?
Canon makes pretty good camera. Canon makes a pretty good camera, Jeff. But comment on Mike's question.
I love that question. I think that's a great question. So they do rate the shutters on cameras. And I think a lot of that is to tell you the difference between, let's say, a consumer camera and a professional camera and the expectations of the shutter. Let's say being on a professional camera can be in the hundreds of thousands. But rarely in 40 years have I replaced shutters in cameras where people have actually worn them out. And I can comically say that I've probably replaced more shutters in cameras where people have put their fingers through them than have needed to replace them by wearing them out.
Okay. Well, Canon came up. When a customer comes into your store wants an all-around good camera, what do you recommend?
Well, we recommend all the major manufacturers, which are Nikon, Canon, Olympus, Sony, and they're pretty much the main players out there. There's not too many small manufacturers out there any longer. We do sell Pentax Ricoh, which is a little more obscure, but they make some attractive cameras too. But we carry most of the main lines of all the cameras.
Bobby in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I heard you guys talking about cameras and whatnot, and I just had a little advice for anybody using a phone camera. Pretty much, it works with most of them, Google phones, iPhones. If you focus the picture and you have flash on and you quickly take that picture, it doesn't take it immediately. So if you quickly turn down the brightness, if you know how to do that on your phone, it'll be perfect. Like, the flash will still work, and the darkness will, the picture will be darker with the flash. So that takes away the glare.
Bobby, thanks for calling. Jeff, correct?
Well, quite often the flash is something that people just don't use anymore because they don't understand it. Older people out there who use flashes for many years because they had to, the camera was no good in low light. Today you have cameras that are fantastic in low light, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't use a flash. A flash will provide a little light in particular to the front of a person's face, which a lot of people still find to be much more pleasing than to have them have a harshness of light, maybe, let's say, from a baseball hat covering up their eyes. So a flash becomes really valuable in those kind of circumstances.
Lynn in Coon Valley, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Yes, I have a question if photography is the best way for me to go. I have some old church documents. They're on yellowish paper. Some of them are actually in pencil. but some are in pen. So the best way to make a copy of them, so when looking at them, you don't have to be handling the originals. Is photography the way to go?
I think photography is still a standard that, you know, everybody uses to document images. You know, it's not too hard to capture a picture of a document with a camera. And the way to make that really good would be to put it in a little light tent, which is a device that you can get for either objects or, in this case, to put a printed material in there. And that way you would get it a very even, nice light to it, and it would reproduce excellent.
Yeah, it should, Lynn. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Samantha in Independence, Wisconsin, called to say she remembered using her father's big instant camera, enjoyed using it while wasting film. Are those cameras coming back at all? I'm reminded of the Polaroids. I think I still have a Polaroid camera somewhere in my closet.
Some of them are worth money again. If it looks like the Tasmanian devil, it's worth a couple hundred. But there certainly is interest in the Polaroid again. I think some of that might have come from some of the musicians like Taylor Swift. I'm not sure. Using Polaroid cameras. There's a local company called Retrospect here in Milwaukee that deals with retro things, and Polaroid cameras are a big part of what they do. And I do have film for Polaroid 600 cameras and SX70 cameras. I believe most of the rest of the film is discontinued and you wouldn't be able to use those cameras.
So you still have the film available. I didn't even know it was still available.
Just for 600 and SX70, but those were the bulk of the cameras that they sold.
I'll have to remember that and dig around and find my Polaroid. Do you mail things like that?
Yeah, we can certainly ship things out to customers like that. It's no problem.
Ah, Mike in Minocqua, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm just starting to do a little bit of bird watching with a group, and I was just wondering what the best camera is for that kind of action. You know, the distance with them moving and that, you know, that kind of. That kind of picture. Does he have a suggestion?
We sell a lot of Olympus cameras to bird watchers, and a lot of those people are on Facebook under Wisconsin Wildlife. And what they do is they provide a camera that's a very modern mirrorless camera with a relatively small telephoto lens that you can now hand hold. You don't really need a tripod. And the quality and effectiveness of that type of bird photography is easily better than it's ever been in history of trying to capture any pictures.
So what was it again, the name of the camera?
Olympus is one of the cameras that we use quite often because they're just physically smaller. Some people like that, and the lenses are physically smaller, but we also do sell a lot of full frame size cameras from Nikon and Canon and Sony. And then the lenses become physically relatively large, let's say like 2 feet long and relatively heavy in comparison to an Olympus, which might be half of that size.
Oh, Mike, there you go. Something to look into. Omar in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Omar.
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have been a client at Microvelos, and one of the things that I would like to let other people know is that their service, it goes way beyond the selling of cameras and lenses. They have a lot of knowledge when it comes to getting all the equipment back in order, getting it restored. I had an experience that was still grateful, or an amazing experience. They guided me on getting an old Kodak Retinet, which is almost a 70 years old camera. And they helped me to find the right place to get it restored. And it was just a very pleasant experience among others, you know, provided by Troy, by John, obviously by Jeff. So it's not just about buying equipment, but they have plenty of experience to share with us, their clients.
Omar, thank you very much for calling. Jeff, that's always a nice thing to hear, I'm sure.
I know who Omar is by his voice, and he's a heck of a nice guy, and I appreciate him saying that.
Yeah, well, Omar, I appreciate it as well. Thank you for calling. Kathy in Fifield will go to you. Hi, Kathy.
I'm looking for a good point-and-shoot camera that I can just grab and shoot with for birds. I currently have a Sony camera, but in low light, it isn't the best. So what is the best point-and-shoot camera for birds?
We've been doing a lot with a Nikon camera. It's called the P950 and the P1000, and they have the longest conventional lenses on any camera. A lot of the point-and-shoot cameras were discontinued over the years. These are a little bit physically bigger, but if there's a bird up in the tree and you have one of those cameras, you zoom in optically on it, and it is absolutely fantastic. You'll fill the whole viewfinder with just the bird.
Now somebody's going to say, what kind of camera was that again?
Nikon P950 or P1000. They're both current.
Nikon.
Yeah, those are Nikons.
Yeah, Nikon. There you go, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your question. The photo restoration work, do you guys, can you colorize old photos, for example?
We do. We have the greatest photo restoration artist that there is. His name is Gary. And he only works here 2 days a week now, Mondays and Tuesdays, but he's an incredible value to have. He can colorize pictures that are absolutely fantastic, either do an automated process or he can go in there and he can add one color at a time from, let's say, a different picture that showed some the color of somebody's hair or known values like a military outfit. But we certainly do that all the time, and we are absolutely blessed to have one of the best photo restoration artists that there is available.
I have a relative who is in a memory care facility, and one of the things I like to do is take photos. I go through the old photos and take them in, and we can look at those photos and talk about those photos. And some of them are much better taken care of than others. What's the best way to protect and keep printed photos?
Well, we use a process today. We just bought a brand new printer, and we use a process today that's really 100-year archival. But when you say 100-year archival, it means it's not sitting in the window, whereas the window light is certainly going to fade it over time. But they are pretty permanent. If you ever wanted to make it more permanent, you could do some kind of laminate to the front of it or some kind of protectorant to the front of it, or even putting it in a frame with, say, let's say, some kind of protective glass on front of it too.
Yeah. Many digital cameras now can shoot video. I would imagine the quality of that will vary quite a bit depending on the camera.
The quality of a current consumer product doing video today is almost as good as the stuff that they use in Hollywood to make motion pictures with. And someday somebody's kid is going to get a hold of a common camera and make a motion picture and have it do well in the movie theaters, because the only thing he needs is a tool that's in his hand, which is a consumer product camera. And there are people who have come and rented cameras or purchased cameras from me that have made motion pictures, much like a guy named Tate Bunker, who was the head of film school at UW-Milwaukee, made a movie that's a great movie called The Field. And that was all done with a consumer product, but professional end of consumer product digital camera.
Oh, Jeff. A pleasure. I hope you can come back and be with us again. This is great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Larry. Appreciate it.
Jeff Dobbs, General Manager of Mike Crivello's Camera and Imaging Center in Brookfield. Thanks to him, and thank you very much for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller. Mama, take my-